Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week, we'll speak with Ohio Congresswoman Chantel Brown about the future of the Farm Bill, year-round E15, and how the war in Iran will impact agriculture. But first, here are this week's headlines. Top Republican Ag and Appropriations Committee leaders recognize the need for additional farm aid, but questions remain about how much and through what vehicle. House Ag Committee Chair Glenn Thompson floated the highest figure yet, $20 billion to help farmers manage surging production costs, with $10 billion for row crop producers and $10 billion for specialty crop growers. The rescue funds would add to $12 billion from the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program unveiled in December to help farmers stay afloat until farm safety net programs go into effect in October. Since then, ag groups have sounded alarms that the financial outlook has weakened amid the war with Iran that's driven higher prices for fuel, fertilizer, and transportation. The top Senate Ag Appropriator, John Hovind, said he's eyeing about $17 billion for farm aid support, but didn't clarify how much for row and specialty crop growers. Surveys show that most farmers can't afford enough fertilizer this spring due to market disruptions from the conflict in Iran, and the impacts will likely continue into at least 2028. Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins has repeatedly said that 75 to 80% of farmers pre-booked their spring fertilizer needs. But an American Farm Bureau Federation survey of nearly 6,000 producers found lower percentages depending on the region. In the Midwest, for example, 2 out of 3 respondents said they got what they needed ahead of time. In the South, however, only 19% had. A separate study from North Dakota State University modeled multiple scenarios, which showed that even if the latest U.S. ceasefire with Iran holds and the Strait of Hormuz reopens in short order, damage to fertilizer infrastructure in the region will keep prices elevated into 2028. The U.S. conflict in Iran is squeezing fuel and fertilizer costs for producers who are beginning or preparing to start planting. We asked House Ag Committee Vice Ranking Member Chantel Brown what concerns her most about the conflict and the repercussions for agriculture.
When I think about this issue, I am concerned about our farmers and getting the fertilizer that they need to plant their crops. We've seen urea is gone up almost 50%. I think it's around 47% in the cost. We know that diesel fuel is also being impacted at $2 more than it was prior to the war per gallon. And so these costs don't only impact the farmers, but they also are going to be transferred and passed down to the consumer. So we're going to see the cost of our food increase. And so I really am very intentional about making sure that these issues that have been historically just focused on the farmers are understood in the ways that they're going to impact the majority of the population. And by doing that, I hope that more people will start to pay attention to these issues so that they get the attention that they deserve.
Yeah, and economists, you know, reports are coming out. They're estimating that the impacts of this, specifically on fertilizer, could, you know, go into 2028. Farmers could be feeling these repercussions. But, you know, as a lawmaker, you know, what should be done from a policy perspective to really alleviate this?
Well, the fact of the matter is that our farmers have been struggling for far too long already with input costs, with equipment costs. And when we talk about how to address those issues, we have to be a little bit more creative, nimble, flexible. I am grateful for Ranking Member Craig's leadership and the act that she put forward, the Farm and Families Relief Act, that addresses some of these issues and dealing with tariffs, dealing with the policies around this conflict that is happening at the Strait of Hormuz. It has to come to an end. I'm looking forward to voting once more on the War Powers Resolution to try to rein in this president and keep the guardrails on.
Yeah, and that was kind of the fertilizer side of things, but fuel also is a big component. And, you know, a lot of the Midwest lawmakers are continuing to advocate for year-round E15
Absolutely.
To bring down fuel prices, but it's really been a contentious issue. And, you know, I'd like your thoughts on if you think it's kind of become partisan in the way that this, you know, E15 Rural Domestic Energy Council has been developed, and, you know, what will it really take to get that across the finish line?
We were so close, right? We were right there on the 1 yard line. And so it has seen bipartisan support. But I think where I would point to is there's a little friction on the other side of the aisle between oil states and corn states, right? And so that's where the issue lies. I think that this is something that If you look at the women, particularly in the Midwest, myself, Congresswoman Angie Craig, Congresswoman Nikki Baczynski, the women of the Midwest are the biggest champions of year-round E15, and we will continue to be. But I think it's incumbent on the other side of the aisle to get their act together, because this makes sense for everyone.
We'll be back with more newsmakers right after this.
As a cooperative, our customers are our owners. They share our profits and help guide our business. We're not just another lender. We're Farm Credit, and we're here for you.
Think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This is my sustainability story.
Welcome back. The Farm Bill passed out of the House Ag Committee earlier this year and now could receive a vote on the House floor before the end of April. We asked House Ag Committee Vice Ranking Member Chantel Brown from Ohio what she makes of the bill and the process the committee has gone through to bring it to the floor.
I want to start off by saying that I think that Chairman Thompson has been well-intentioned, that he has led with trying to find bipartisan solutions. And we actually had some agreements in the past that were undercut and undermined by the administration. So I think the process became a little bit frustrating for our leadership because of that, where we had agreements, they weren't fulfilled because the Trump said no go. And so unfortunately for GT, that made it very difficult for our leadership to come to the table with confidence that we could come up with bipartisan agreement. However, I will say that there were some motions made by the Republican leadership to try to attempt at saying, look, we'd like to have some bipartisanship, but we didn't meet at the table. It was kind of like, hey, what about this? Kind of speaking to members individually, that I think that they felt they could potentially leverage that they knew might be in vulnerable positions. And so I did not find that to be the best approach, but in all, the farm bill is what it is. For many of us on the Democratic side, I don't think that it was a good starting point when we did not address the SNAP cuts, the SNAP provision to have the states administer the cost of the program. That is going to be disastrous, and Republicans and Democratic governors have both indicated that that cannot be sustainable for states, and so that is a huge red flag. But the other thing is the $1 billion cuts to conservation, the cutting of funds for research, and the failure to expand the scholarship, 1890 scholarship program. Those are pretty much non-starters for a person like me. And so if we're going to be serious, and we have to look at those things, and here we are.
Yeah, and now we're, seeing the Farm Bill, a vote on the House floor. Chairman Thompson says potentially before the end of April. He did recognize yesterday when I was speaking to him some of those poison pills, the Proposition 12 included in there, the pesticide preemption, but said that he's working with both Democrats and Republicans to get the votes needed on that. I'm curious, it will be on the House floor. Is that something that, with how important the Farm Bill is, you could potentially vote for? And where do you think that your Democrat colleagues are at?
Well, I think if we don't address the issue around the cost shift to states, that it's going to be difficult to get a lot of support from the Democrats. And that, because again, that's going to impact so many folks. And we saw that during the initial, the first government shutdown around the holidays in November, October, November. And so we don't, that would be a starting point, but certainly if we can't even get that on the table, I'm not sure that we'll get a lot of support from my colleagues on the Democrat side.
Yeah. And when we look to the future of the Ag Committee, Ranking Member Craig now will be leaving to pursue her Senate run. So she'll complete the end of this Congress. And you will be the next in line to be the top Democrat on the House Ag Committee. So I'm curious, just, you know, your tenure on the committee, your tenure in Congress, kind of how, I guess, maybe first question, if you'd, you know, still be open to that top Democrat on the committee, but also, you know, how you would maybe lead the committee different than what we've seen this Congress.
Well, certainly would be interested, but my main priority, as I continue to say, is supporting the ranking member, supporting the committee and the caucus, however they need me. I think under Ranking Member Craig's leadership, she has been amazing. I am grateful that she has really taken me under her wing, included me in the leadership conversation, so that when the moment arises, I would be in a great position to be able to hit the ground running. I think that because we're in a place where the Farm Bill has been in such a so long overdue, right, that it gives us an opportunity to reimagine some things, I know, and bring all of the, rebuild that Farm Bill coalition, and to bring all 12 titles to the table, back to the table, so that we can figure out how to give a little so that everyone wins, and not robbing Peter to pay Paul. I don't think it's fair that we take from one title to pay for another. And so I would love to be able to bring that type of coalition back, and to, again, to your point, to be able to get wins that have bipartisan support, like year-round E15 across the finish line, that would be ideal. So I'm cautiously optimistic about the future. I do want to get a farm bill done. Let me be clear about that. That would be ideal, because our farmers need it.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Hunneke looks at the top destinations for American ag exports in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
U.S. agricultural exports have fallen over the past couple years and are projected to continue falling slightly this year. Despite that fact, the U.S. plays an important part of global agricultural trade. This chart shows the top destinations for American ag exports from 2000 to 2025. According to USDA data, Mexico was the largest market for American ag exports in 2025, receiving more than $30 billion worth of goods. Canada is right behind, receiving slightly more than $28 billion. The European Union, Japan, and South Korea round out the top five. Those five countries accounted for 56% of American ag exports last year. This comes as Brazil is expanding its competitiveness with the United States and is setting a record for soybean exports while trade tensions remain between the U.S. and China. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Hunneke.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper from our branded facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put four kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
For 35 years, soybean farmers have invested together to build demand for U.S. soy at home and around the world. Through the Soy Checkoff, farmers turn every dollar into stronger markets for U.S. soybeans, driving innovation and partnerships across feed, food, fuel, sustainable production, and beyond, led by farmers and built to last. U.S. Soy, 35 years of delivering value back to the farm and investing in the future of agriculture.
Welcome back. As the U.S. conflict in Iran has continued, fuel and fertilizer prices have been upended. We asked Joe Glauber with the International Food Policy Research Institute what he's watching as the conflict progresses.
This time around, it's essentially supply side. It's energy and fertilizer that's having big impacts on producers around the world. I mean, the good news is that, you know, for Northern Hemisphere, a lot of the fertilizer has been purchased. I mean, you still see, like the survey the Farm Bureau did the other day, and others saying that some farmers here have not yet purchased and they're having problems. But I think generally, you know, when I look at it from a standpoint of global production, I don't think we'll see the much impacts with the spring planted crops. I think where the concern will be, other than switching from corn to soybeans and some of the cropping decisions that will be made because of higher input prices. Where the concern will be, I think, is later in the year when Southern Hemisphere starts planning.
Yeah, and lawmakers on Capitol Hill have, you know, begun talking about an aid package to support producers, but that's more of a short-term fix. I mean, when you think larger picture structural changes, I mean, what really needs to be done, maybe specifically on that fertilizer issue, to really support the market, that support fertilizer that these farmers need?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, to a degree, we're shooting ourselves in the foot with some of the countervail and anti-dumping duty, you know, the domestic trade remedies that we have on imports. That's all done according using U.S. law. And so, you know, the fertilizer industry has come in and said it needs that sort of protection, and commerce and ITC have agreed with that. But I think that's a concern, you know, from the farmer's standpoint, because obviously prices have been high, and that's been one of the biggest concerns over the last couple of years has been the high input costs.
Yeah, and Joe, you mentioned earlier in our conversation the Southern Hemisphere, but Brazil has really significantly expanded soybean acres in recent years, and we saw China really greatly benefit from that last fall, buying a lot of Brazil's soybeans. But, you know, do you think that those lost acres and market share that the U.S. lost to Brazil in the last year, specifically with soybeans, but in general, you know, do you think those are permanent or more of a single year thing?
Yeah, I fear they're permanent. I mean, if you were to look at the experience of 2018-19, Brazil brought in, I think, over the 3 years or so, right, you know, starting with 2018, they brought in around 13 million acres and over that period of soybeans. And that's a lot, you know, and that's a market share that we haven't seen come back. Yes, it's true that the more Brazil ships to China, we get a little bit of some of the other business in the world. But unfortunately, global market share, and in particular in China, that's just something that now Brazil owns a much larger piece of than they did prior to 2018. There's no question the U.S. is very competitive in the global soybean market for about 5 months during the year. That's when the Northern Hemisphere is, you know, harvest is on. That's when our prices are lowest. We sell a lot around the world, particularly to China during that period. But when you take our largest market and the world's largest market for soybeans and declare that sort of because of the trade frictions, all of a sudden have difficulties shipping soybeans to China, that really hurts your market. And yes, we'll recover now and hopefully get back well above the 25 million that was agreed to. I think if we can get back to where we're trading on an equal basis, I mean, remember, we still have a 13% tariff going into China. I mean, all this trade deal aside, China has a 13% tariff against us relative to the 3% that they charge Brazil. So we're at a competitive disadvantage, unfortunately.
We'll be back with more newsmakers right after this.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper from our branded facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put 4 kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
America never stops. Thanks to the financial support of Farm Credit, neither do the farmers and ranchers who call her home. Since the beginning, we've been helping rural America show the world what hard work can achieve. But the job is far from over. And as rural America grows further, we'll be there.
Welcome back. Brazil is a global soybean powerhouse constrained by transportation bottlenecks. My colleague Oliver Ward traveled to the heart of Brazilian agriculture in Mato Grosso to examine the infrastructure challenges for the sector and the country's efforts to improve them. Let's take a look at his report.
Thank you. soybean farm in the state of Mato Grosso.
I'm Oliver Ward, and here I am on a very windy Bartan family farm in early February. Simone Bartan planted this soybean field in late September. Now, a little over 4 months later, it's ready to harvest. Bartan has enough storage for about half of what she produces, which is more than most in this part of Brazil. But half of the crop will go straight to market, and that means getting it to ships thousands of kilometers away for export to China, the largest buyer. The Bartan farm is in the center of Mato Grosso, which means this can happen two ways. The beans can head north to Miritituba, where they're put on barges and transported to a port at Belém, or they can go south to Rondonópolis, where there's a rail terminal that can take them to Santos Port. But both involve long truck journeys of hundreds of miles on single-lane highways, which is expensive.
The roads in the interior of Brazil are not very good, and the crops grow in a faster pace than the infrastructure can grow. This overloads all the roads and all the ports also, and this is the main reason why freights and logistical costs overall in Brazil are so high.
In February, as the soybean harvest got underway, truck drivers in the north of the country faced days-long traffic jams.
Also, it's not good for the Brazilian producer, and it takes away some of the competitiveness of Brazilian grains in the export market.
Although Brazil's operating costs are well below the US's, its transportation costs are higher. A typical producer in Mato Grosso faces costs around $30 a ton higher than a producer in Minnesota when shipping to China. All of this price differential comes from internal transportation
in the form of truck and rail costs.
Industry representatives believe if they can make headway on Brazil's infrastructure woes, Brazil will be more competitive globally.
Nós temos a grande vantagem do clima tropical permitir fazer duas safras por ano, né? Então eles sabem que nós, com todas as dificuldades que enfrentamos, principalmente o gargalo logístico, ainda conseguimos ser eficientes.
Beber is optimistic that Brazil is on the cusp of unlocking lower transportation costs.
Então, no lugar deles, eu também teria essa preocupação.
The country's top court is weighing whether to allow a major rail project to proceed, known as Ferrogrão, or the grain train. The project would connect Sinop in the heart of Mato Grosso to rivers in the north that could move soybeans to the port. Beber says it could cut logistics costs by around a third. But the project faces fierce opposition from climate groups, and even if approved, completion is a very long way off. More promising to some is a less ambitious project to extend the existing railway in the south of the state. Brazil's largest rail operator expects the line to reach Lucas do Rio Verde in central Mato Grosso by 2031, and at least one port terminal operator is betting this will facilitate exports.
I believe that in the next maybe 5 to 10 years, Santos will need more capacity for grains.
That's Fabio Sicarino, the CEO at DP World, which operates a terminal at Santos Port. A new $500 million investment DP is planning will add capacity to export another 9 million tons of grain out of the port each year. That's an almost 15% increase.
With the growth of the market, I believe our terminal will be full in the third or fourth year of operation.
The new terminal, currently an empty lot, is expected to be fully operational by mid-2028, he says. DP also sees opportunities in addressing some of Brazilian agriculture's other challenges.
We are building some facilities, mainly warehouses in the countryside, contract logistics operations, freight forwarding, so we are growing.
The operator has opened 6 new offices in the south of the country and plans to open more in the north.
In terms of grain business, we do see a huge opportunity to keep growing in this segment. Grains is something very, very strong in Brazil. It's a segment to see every time and look for new opportunities.
For AgriPulse, I'm Oliver Ward.
Register now for the 2026 AgriPulse Food and Ag Issue Summit in California. The event will offer participants a full day of presentations and panel discussions. You can hear from members of the California Legislature, food and agriculture leaders, along with industry experts and academics. The summit takes place June 2nd in Sacramento. See the latest information and register today under the Events tab at agripulse.com.
I was kind of known as the sheep guy around here. The fire went from north to south and it blew that way and it went straight down the house. Lost all of our sheep literally a week before we start lambing. And I was really in a bad place. I happened to notice this farm state of mind piece of paper. I picked up my cell phone and I made a phone call, and that was the best phone call in my life. I'm glad that I'm still here. So don't do something permanent over a temporary situation.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Both the House and Senate will be in session next week. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.